This is Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy, the arts of attracting, acquiring, and retaining talent. Here's Kathleen.
Welcome back to the conclusion of my discussion with Lou Adler, the CEO and founder of Performance-Based Hiring Learning Systems and the author of Hire With Your Head, Using Performance-Based Hiring to Build Great Teams. Lou, I want to get into your Diversity Hiring Without Compromise initiative and your focus on developing a colorblind hiring process. I think it's interesting because it ensures you get the best people hired regardless of race, religion, age, sexual preference, and physical challenge.
Well, I think, let me go back, and I'm going to say it was 1990, but I'm not positive that's true. And I read this article about what's called a Black Curtain audition for the Vienna Philharmonic. The dates could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. And at the point in time, and let's assume it was 1990, they only would offer these roles to men because everybody on the board or auditioning felt men were better musicians than women. But they decided to go to a black curtain audition where you couldn't see the musician playing. They just would play, and then the people judging this person's performance couldn't see who it was. They could just hear the music. So they judged purely on the music itself. And at that time, it became 50-50. There was no difference in musical quality between man and woman. So that's the idea. Now, up to then, it turned out from my perspective, if someone could, so this is when I take the assignment, hey, if someone can do this work, so I tell this to the hiring manager. We've now defined the job as a series of performance objectives. Build the team, launch the product, conduct the due diligence, and put a plan in place to solve the problem within 6 months. It was a series of performance objectives. And I always say to the hiring manager, if I can find someone who can do that work, would you at least see the person? Not necessarily, but even if they had a different mix of skills and experience. So that was a key tipping point. Define the job as a series of performance objectives. Ask the hiring manager, would you at least see the person if they could do the work? And as part of that, I always would submit, rather than just a resume, I'd say, we're presenting this candidate because he or she, whatever the person's name, mm-hmm. had accomplished a task like this. And could you please review this task and that accomplishment either in a phone call or when you first meet the candidate as the beginning of it? So I really controlled what the assessment was going to be like. It was, hey, can the person do the work you've defined in the intake meeting? Now, indirectly, that came out that it was blind audition. Hey, I didn't care if the person was black or white, old or young, green or yellow. If they could do the work, they deserved the job. So in 1990-ish, I was with a labor law firm that heard that. I can't remember, Fisher and Phillips. I think it was Fisher and Phillips, and I hadn't heard that name in 30 years. But they had heard, hey, would you speak to our clients about the idea of an objective interview process? And then I told the story of the Black Curtain audition and why this was important. So it turned out to be that kind of became the genesis of this idea of diversity hiring. And now this is where there might be an interesting argument. And a lot of the people I were placing early on were CPAs and people in accounting management and director level and controller level positions. When I went back and looked at it, at least half, if not more than half, of the people I placed were women, and they're equally as competent. And I'm thinking, this is where I had some kind of discussion with a couple of VPs, is I never felt there was a wage gap. Maybe there was, maybe there is, but I didn't want to get into that. But it turned out that these women were equally as competent, but they didn't make this big deal about the compensation. It was about, hey, this is a great job and I'm happy to take it. And when I was dealing with guys for the same roles, it was always a battle of, I need 5 or 10% more. And I just said, oh, screw it. I didn't want to deal with them. It was easier to deal with women. And I'd make more, it was equally as good. They stayed 2 to 3 years. They got promoted. So as far as I was concerned, it was just easier. So that's probably, I've added some icing to the idea of diversity hiring. But the idea of a performance-based job description, defining performance as a series of performance objectives, is the deal breaker. That's the tipping point. I now have worked with the absolute number one labor attorney in the country. His name is David Goldstein. He's at Littler Mendelsohn. He's the chair of the OFCCP and the EEOC practice at Littler Mendelsohn, which is the number one labor attorney. If you go to performancebasedhiring.com, you can download a white paper that he's written that says, defining work as a series of performance objectives is far better than defining work as a series of skills, experience, and competencies. In fact, he goes on to say that by looking at performance objectives, you open the talent pool to everybody who can do the work, irrespective of color, age, physical challenges, diversity, sexual preferences. So that was a long story, Kathleen, to your question, but that's the genesis of it, and it's still true today. If you define work as a series of performance objectives and have hiring managers meet people who can do that work, you've just automatically opened the pool to all types of candidates. And if they, as long as they can do the work, they're perfectly, you have the obligation to hire those people. But if you don't, if you define work as a series of skills, experience, and competencies, you've had bias right away because diverse candidates don't meet that criteria to begin with. So even, and it's not necessarily the words you have in the intake meeting, it's the skills and the screening criteria you put in there that really creates a diverse or non-diverse population of candidates you're seeing.
Well, and I think that also rings true as you, when you're looking at defining performance objectives, it opens up your pool, right? Because not only do you have to recruit out of the company's competitors or in that specific industry, you can look at like industries. When they go on the skill set, they're not seen outside of the box, if you will.
Absolutely true. But I want to give a story because this is an interesting one. It's also, personality is a key judgment of people when they make bias. So I remember many, many years ago, it was a search project I had for a cost manager for a big medical device company. CFO was a bear. I had one candidate who was a bit soft-spoken. Everybody in the company loved the guy, manufacturing people, director of accounting, plan, everybody in the financial department other than the CFO. He had a 10-minute meeting and thought the guy was too soft to implement a big SAP implementation project and lead it. I had a call to get the CFO up, and he was adamant that my candidate wasn't any good until I told him that he implemented a similar cost project in an automotive industry using SAP, exactly the same cost system in a UAW plant. When I had the evidence, I say the fact that he was soft-spoken turned out to be an asset because he didn't aggravate the manufacturing people, and he understood what they needed, and he provided value to them. CFO interviewed the guy against the next day, dug into his accomplishments, and realized he made a huge mistake in discounting the guy because he was soft. So I think the moral of that is you need evidence to validate the person is competent. You can't use emotions, particularly as a third-party recruiter. You can't out-yell a hiring manager, but you can out-fact that manager, and I think that's key. But you also have to teach managers to look for evidence of performance, not make judgments based on superficialities and skills that, and factors that don't predict performance. And most hiring managers are totally biased. So you have to control how that interview is conducted, and you have to use evidence as the key to drive the process forward.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. So Lou, I reached out to a few of my recruiters and I told them that I was going to be having this conversation with you, and several of them sent questions. So let me share with you some of the questions that they have for you. One of them was, we unanimously agree with your observation that top people are looking for growth, challenge, and learning opportunities rather than just short-term monetary gains. You mentioned a consultative recruiting approach to converting a job into a career move. She'd like to know a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so I'm going to say 40 years ago, we came up with a question that we always ask candidates. And the question was, and these are generally passive candidates or people we found through referrals. They might have been semi-open, at least they're open to talk. But the question we asked was, would you be open to explore a situation if it were clearly superior to what you're doing today? And the idea is we sell the conversation, not the job. Let's just have a conversation. Now, frequently a candidate will come back to that. And we got like 90% yeses. We spent a week asking, we had like 30 different questions. What can we do to get a yes? That was the question. How do we get a yes? We also created emails as how do we get someone to talk to us to ask that question? But the question itself was, would you be open to explore a situation if it were clearly superior to what you're doing today? It's pretty hard to say no to that. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to say no to that if that person was referred to you, because you'd say something, hey, hi, Kathleen, I got your name from Georgia. Not that you were looking, just that you were someone exceptional, someone I should network with. But let me just ask you this question, Kathleen. Would you be open to explore a situation clearly superior to what you're doing today? Candidate would typically say, particularly if it was a referral, 100% they talk to you and 100% chance they'd say yes. But frequently they would say, well, what's the money? So that was the first situation. Once they say that, we pretty much know they're interested. But the retort to that is, it really doesn't matter, Kathleen, what the compensation is if it's not a career move. Let's first see if it's a career move, and then we'll see if the compensation fits. If not, we'll just network. So it's a very low-key conversation, and it's really permission marketing. We just want to have a 10-minute conversation to see if this represents. If not, we'll network and stay in touch. But then sometimes candidates say, well, what do you define by a career move? And this is where I say, well, I've got to give you, and this is really the key point, because I'm at the moment I talk to a candidate, I'm trying to convince them that the decision, if you're the candidate 2 or 3 or 4 weeks from now, the decision won't be about money, it'll be about career opportunity. So they say, well, what's a career opportunity? I said, in my mind, Kathleen, we have to get at least a 30% increase, 30%, but none of it's money. 30%'s got to include some job stretch. That could be 5 or 10%, bigger job. It's got to have a mix of more satisfying work. It's got to have a job that has more impact, more satisfying from a work-life balance standpoint. And as important, we not just year one, this has got to continue multiple years. We have to prove that to you. I recognize that's going to take some time. What I'd like to do now is just see if we're even in the game. And if so, we can decide later if we want to get serious. So it's, I'm setting the stage as we're selling the discussion, not the job. Now, if I think the candidate's strong and I can prove that I believe there's a 30%, I will get more serious. If I don't, hey, Kathleen, it's not a big enough job or it's too big a job, but I use that 30% as the idea that that's what we have to look for as a minimum to justify a career move. And it's got to be a multi-year kind of a program. When you do those things, you can engage with a person at least on a reasonable business-like level. But to do that, you have to know the job. You have to be a good interviewer. You have to know the industry. You have to have done your research. You can't do that if you're doing 30 recs. You can do it if you're doing 5 recs and dealing with more people. And I like to spend more time with fewer people who are semifinalists. Does that kind of give you a sense for that response? I think it's a very important question too.
Yeah, no. And another person asked the question that, you know, and you talked about this earlier about really being aggressive or assertive even, to make sure you get that candidate's attention. And so he says, many recruiters have difficulty taking what you call the direct frontal attack and in how to respond to the 3 most common passive candidates, which he actually shared with our internal Slack this last week. So his question is, how do you coach recruiting teams to have these difficult conversations and take control of the conversation with the passive talent?
Well, let's say this. That's why I think referrals are gold. No question. Mm-hmm. If you get referrals, they're gold. Because, oh, I didn't know you knew this person. Well, and it's like what I call it's talking to a stranger whom you have no credibility whatsoever with is always awkward. So, I mean, let's just be real frank. Talking with someone who's referred to you, that former stranger is kind of a semi-acquaintance almost. Oh, how is Georgia? I haven't talked to her in a long time. So it breaks the ice a little bit. That's why I really spend a lot of time getting referrals. The first time I talk with someone, I've sent that person an email. I've kind of defined the job at a very high level, includes the EVP, and the fact that I just want to talk to this person about a career opportunity. And I might even define, hey, I might even in the outbound email, I might say, this is a career, I just want to have a conversation with you. In my network, more than 30, 40 years ago, for the first 5 or 10 years, all I did was work with accountants, CPAs out of the major accounting firms. Now it's a big 4. At the time, it was a big 8 and then big 6 and big 5, whatever. So I knew, so even though I had, and I got referrals all the time from those people. So it became then after a while, I decided I didn't like talking to accountants and controllers, but I placed a lot of people in controller and CFO positions. Then I got into more retained search and it was more with mid-sized companies. But as long as I developed the network, people, oh, you're the guy who placed this guy and this guy. So there was some credibility established with that knowledge. But sometimes it's pure cold. But because when I get someone on the phone, I'm pretty persistent, but I'm pretty confident I know the job. I mean, when they talk to me, when I get someone on the phone, they know that I know what I'm talking about. It's not a game for me. I know that job. I am persistent as heck. I understand the management team. I understand the job. I understand the hiring manager. I understand the industry. And I said, let me just ask you a few questions about your background. And now I've written articles, so people can find me that way. But back 20 years ago, I didn't write articles. I mean, I had a book, but nobody knew about it at the time.
Right.
So, but I had a lot of personal confidence that I knew the job. And I think that's part of it. But I think getting referrals is equally part of it. And we really had a goal in our, and even our training started out at, we called it CJ University. We had about 10 or 15 people who were researchers and sourcers and recruiters. And every week we talked about, how do you get referrals? How do you get the person on the phone? What question did you use? So you had to make 10 outbound calls. We wanted at least 7 of them to come back. How do you get those? How do you get people to respond? We really worked very hard, creating compelling emails, having prepared phone scripts, being able to overcome every single objection. A lot of that is in our training tools that you'd find on windowandhiring.com, but and a lot of them in that book as well. I don't know if that answers the question, because I wasn't 100% sure what the underlying problem was in that question, but hopefully that gave some advice.
No, I think that will provide a great deal of insight. You know, one of the other things I want to kind of go back to about, you sell the conversation and not the job. So now you're getting to this, the career opportunity, and again, what things are going to look like on that anniversary date. I'm asked all the time, how do I get these candidates across the finish line? They're coming back at me. I'm making them this offer. We've had this great conversation, and now all of a sudden they're coming at me with more stuff. You know, I want these benefits. I want this. Are you hearing that same thing from your clients and seeing that in the candidates that your team is presenting, or does your process help weed some of that out?
Yes. So let me kind of go through it. And that's why you should send some of your recruiters to our training. We actually cover all of this stuff here. And it's obviously not in the book, but a couple of things. Let's assume that I was recruiting you, Kathleen, and I go through the 30% solution, and I really like your background, but it's just the first call. So I have a 30, 40 minute call with the candidate initially. Then I say something like this, Kathleen, you know, I'd really like to, I think this could be interesting, but I have to get my hiring manager to agree to be part of the same engagement and let's go slow process. So I say, Kathleen, what I'd like to do is arrange an exploratory call with the hiring manager about your background. I perceive this job to represent a good career move. I think you'll find it a bigger team to manage. Company's growing faster, might be a little bit concerned that the technology might be a version a little bit ahead of where you are, but that would offer growth stretch. But nonetheless, based on what your background is, it looks like this could be interesting. But before we get too serious, I'd like to see if I can arrange a conversation with the hiring manager to see if it makes sense. And I do this. So if in my search requirement, I tell the hiring manager, you're going to do it my way. If you don't do it my way, I can't do the search. So they have to buy, my clients have to buy into the performance-based hiring methodology. No choice. That is the rule that we're going to play by. And I am persistent with hiring managers and companies as well as I am with candidates. But hiring manager, and it's not a hard sell. They trust me. I mean, again, I've written some books about it, but when you know the job and ask the question in the intake meeting, hiring managers kind of trust you. Oh, man, you actually know what you're talking about. So that's not an insignificant step. But I say, Kathleen, the purpose of this meeting is for you to see if it's a career move, not a money move. In fact, let's assume it's a lateral transfer, a modest increase. But on the other hand, it's going to be offset by a major growth increase. So this is going to be your chance to begin the due diligence process. But I also want to set the stage here, Kathleen. If you were to get an offer 4 weeks from now, and an offer is only 5% more than you're making today, that's all, just a little bit. Before you get that offer, 3 or 4 days before you get the offer, I'm going to call you up and ask you this question. So I want you to think about it now, because this is what you're going to meet when you meet with the hiring manager. Forget the money. Forget the comp, forget the vacation, forget everything other than the job. Do you really want this job? I'm going to ask you this before you get an offer. And I'm going to expect that you to come back, yes, I want it, because of what I call the 30% solution. You're going to find stretch, you're going to find growth, you're going to find impact, you're going to find good team, you're going to find long-term career growth. That's the purpose of this, your due diligence, is to find that. If we don't have that, don't take the job no matter what the comp is, no matter what the benefit package. Just don't worry about it. Only worry about if this job is a good, true career move. That will enhance your background in the next 2 to 3 or 4 years. But if you focus too much in the short term on what you're getting on the start date, you'll miss the long-term opportunity. So I set the stage. This is before you've met the hiring manager. And I'm repeating this constantly through every interview. Now you got the full day interview, Kathleen. Tell me through, what do you know about this 30% solution? Tell me about this. What have you learned? What's missing? And then towards the end, I say, I want you to rank this job, Kathleen. This is like a week before an offer is being made. I want you to rank this job, Kathleen, on a scale of 0 to 10. A 10 meaning you'll take it no matter what. A 9, very interesting. And I say, rank it in comparison to everything else you're looking at. Everything. Even a counteroffer. How would you rank this job? And by this time, a week before an offer is made, 2 to 3 meetings with a company, if I don't get an 8, I'm in trouble. It's a done deal. It's not going to happen. But I then say, it's an 8. It's probably right there in my short list of 2 things, including a counteroffer. I say, Kathleen, what would it take to be a 9? And a 9 is as good as it gets. And then I listen to what you say. And I'm saying, are you really, Kathleen, you know, you valued what you get on the start date more than where you're going. So I then know what my competition is and how this candidate is making that decision. Are they focusing on the career opportunity or what they get on the start date or the short-term stuff? And then I reposition it. Kathleen, this is what's important to your life. That's what most of the book is about. That's what our training is about, is setting the stage to ensure that the focus is on where this person's going, what the job can be. You will never have enough money. There'll always be something. There'll be too much, not a long enough vacation, not the benefit package. Yeah, you're going to try to negotiate that. But if they don't buy into the job itself, you're going to lose for some of these dumb negotiating reasons. Not to say that you win all the time, but I rarely lose when I'm focusing on the career growth. And if it's not a good career move, I back off. I mean, I can't create something that doesn't exist, or I'll go back to the company and make it a bigger job. So,
no, I agree. And I think it's important that hiring leaders too, and that they remember you have to ask these questions more than once.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I had this board meeting last week, which I didn't know. I knew the investment group, 6 members of the board. I had the guy with a private equity group. They got about 35% of the company. One of the other groups has 45% of the company, but it's kind of a hands-off people who run the company. And I'm kind of guiding them through. I never thought about defining the job this way. Oh, thank you. Can you interview the candidates for us? I mean, really, when you understand the job at that level of what does this person need to do to be successful, your role as a recruiter changes. Mm-hmm. You have so much more, I don't want to say control, but influence on who is seen, who is hired, and how you negotiate the close. But if you're just a typical recruiter taking a typical job description, you're just competing on superficialities and you set yourself up. So now, again, I wrote a book and that's credible. And I tell people, and I'm pretty forceful. I'm from New York and I've lost search assignments because I'm forceful, but I believe it to be true. And I was probably the first contingency firm in the world to give a 1-year guarantee. And when I went to retain, it was a 2-year guarantee. But back in the early 80s, I gave a 1-year guarantee and it got religion that way. I said, okay, I got to do everything right. And I took it more seriously than my clients, but it became a valuable approach.
Well, and if you're focusing on the anniversary date, it's a 1-year guarantee in your head anyway, just from and you talk about trust anyway. So yeah, you were definitely ahead of your time.
Yeah, well, hey, yeah. Sometimes somebody asked me, I said, are you happy about this? I said, not really. I said, I'm proud of the work of using performance-based hiring, but it is hard to get people to use it at scale. And again, for a lot of reasons. So it is hard work. But I think for a recruiter getting a 30% or more fee, it's mandatory work.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. You know, you talked about asking for referrals. Referrals are king. And then I'd like to ask you about if you do any work with corporate boards, because I do a lot of work with the 50-50 Women on Boards initiative. And they always say that 80% of board seats are found through, you know, networking. And now that gender parity, having more diverse boards is a goal of you know, the stockholders are telling their boards that they need to, are demanding this, right? Do you work with corporate boards at all or have these conversations with them about how to follow this process to go out there and start networking with talent to build that trust to see if they're going to be potential members of their board. I mean, it would seem like a no-brainer to me.
Well, let's say this. I do work with boards all the time on hiring their senior executive team. I have not worked with boards on hiring other board members. But if I was in that situation, I say, okay, what does it take to be a good board member? In fact, this one board I was talking about, none of the people on the board really have operational experience to run a manufacturing facility is what they're running. And this is a very profitable business. And I said, I'm always dumbfounded. How could you guys let the CEO run ragged here without controls? I happen to have one of my old clients was the CEO of a big manufacturing and distribution company. And I had breakfast with him. Keith, you should be on the board here. He didn't want to be. He said, no, I don't want to be on a board. I got too many boards that I'm working on. But I could have convinced the board to see him because I've set the stage. But irrespective of that, if I was to make the pitch to, hey, we need a woman on the board, forget the diverse component. Let me ask you, what does it take to be a good board member here? And I would then build a performance-based job description for that and then say, let's go find people who could provide that kind of value add to the board. Not just diversity of thought, but also improving the goal of the board to ensure that this company is meeting its performance and business objectives. So I would kind of use the same, what you call a no-brainer. It would be, yeah, why not do the same exact process and then evaluate a board member that way, but do it in a slower manner. And I know that the idea from stranger to acquaintance is it shouldn't be a transactional process. It should be a strategic evaluation process on both sides. Hey, we need a board member who's a woman. That person has to think strategically about our business, whatever the business needs. There's got to be things on the board that the board is not achieving from a perspective of what are they doing, operational, strategic, product, whatever it is. What are the gaps in the board? And let's find someone who can do that. So to me, it would be a logical step in that right direction.
I really do agree with your the stranger to acquaintance. What I'm hearing too is that companies are starting to have a little bit of vision as to what the next 90 days are going to start looking like in terms of their hiring and realizing that they need to go out there and build these talent pools of candidates so that these people that they don't know today, they can continue to build those relationships and then be ready to hire them either 90 days or 6 months from now. Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you one other question about something I saw in your LinkedIn bio, and it's when you were the CEO of powerhiring.com, and you say, you developed the greatest hiring tool in the world and somehow lost money. As a fellow entrepreneur, what happened?
Well, we got funded, let's say it's probably equivalent in today's dollars, about $4 or $5 million. We got funded on the day the dot-com boom busted, blew up.
Oh.
I mean, like a week before. So I said, oh God, everything is over. And we were supposed to go for 9 months with the money we had. And we kept it going 2 years, but we realized it was the wrong product at the wrong time. We should have embedded it into, we were trying to create an ATS system in combination with a hiring process. And so that was what went wrong. It was just, we got hung up in the dot-com business. That's why I stopped becoming a full-time recruiter. I said, okay, I'm going to try to pull this off. And then I still did recruiting for another 10 years after that, but my heart wasn't in it. I was still trying to say, hey, let's create a training company that can implement this performance-based hiring. So that's why I told this woman the other, she said, boy, you're really successful. I said, well, I think performance-based hiring is a valid process and it still works every time we use it, but we haven't really been able to automate it the way it could have been. For a variety of reasons. So, and it really was, that was the catalyst that set us off in the wrong direction.
Mm. Well, there's still time, Lou, still time.
No, I don't think so. I got other things on the agenda.
Well, what do they say? Sometimes the biggest crisis turns into the greatest opportunity. So, you know, keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, sometimes they say that, and sometimes, but more times than not, it doesn't.
Well, I remember the dot-com boom too, so...
Yeah, they always forget, well, somebody's going to be successful. Yeah, but the 95% turned out to lose their shirt. So nonetheless, it was interesting times.
Yes, it was. It was. They've all been interesting times, especially the current time. Well, listen, before I let you go, where can people go to purchase your book?
Well, if they go to Amazon and look for Higher With Your Head, they'll find it right there. That's the best place to get it. If you're going to get the book, the Kindle version is actually superior, particularly if it's read on a iPad, because number one, the images are in color, you can keep notes. It's really a pretty powerful experience to get a textbook-like book on an iPad, because it really is offers a lot more than just a printed book. You can keep your yellow stickies and all your notes there and refer to it back and forth. And it keeps the hot link. There's probably 100 hot links in the book that go back to web pages and references. So it's pretty cool. And you can also download all the tools. And we have a place where you can download the tools. So that's how I would do it. Then join our book club at higherwithyourhead.com.
Yeah, the book looks great. And to learn more about the training, where should they go to that?
Well, I think if you go to higherwithyourhead.com, you'd find the training opportunity. And also we have a series of online courses at winwinhiring.com. So that would get you some good insight. So Hire With Your Head on Amazon, go to higherwithyourhead.com to get a lot of the resources and join the book club, and Win-Win Hiring to get a series of self-paced classes as well as our live classes.
Well, thank you, Lou. It certainly doesn't sound like you're slowing down.
I'm trying to.
Well, I've enjoyed our conversation today. And again, I encourage everyone to check out his new book, and it's outstanding. I recommend it highly.
Great. Thank you very much, Kathleen. And thank you for inviting me to your podcast today.
Oh, you're so welcome, Lou. His name is Lou Adler, the CEO and founder of Performance-Based Hiring Learning Systems. And that's it for this episode of Revolutionizing Recruitment. I hope you enjoyed the show. And if you did, make sure you take a second to subscribe so you'll automatically get my new shows when they drop. Also, if you have a minute, I'd love if you left me a review so more folks like yourself can discover the show. Until next time, take care.
This has been Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy. To connect with Kathleen or to learn more about recruitment research, go to duffygroup.com.